lunatics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and we're changing things up because today I'm joined by Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to doing the show with you again. It's been, we did one a little while ago together, and I always appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Yeah, because the last time it was our three person show with Kristen. So now we get to, you know, it'll just be the two of us. Now I do want to, for listeners, kind of take you through what we're gonna get through, and anything we don't get to, of course, is going to be coming in our bonus show, right? So for supporters, you have the opportunity to have access to the bonus show. So just remember, if we don't get to it in the main show, supporters are going to have access to that in the bonus show. So what Mike and I are going to start off with, we're going to be talking again about what the recent developments on the debt, specifically what had happened just a couple of days ago and yesterday. We're also going to move forward, and we're going to be chatting about the Facebook whistleblower and kind of what's been happening there, and the Wall Street Journal's report on Instagram, really just kind of social media and politics right there. We're going to move forward and take a look at another big issue this day. In this case, U.S. District Court Robert Pittman striking down, or granting an injunction, I should say, against Texas Senate Bill 8 on abortion. Then we're going to move forward and talk about the release of the Pandora Papers this moment. We're going to especially talk about North Dakota in that case. And then we're going to move forward, and we're going to be talking about Taiwan and China. And then we're going to move on, if we have time, to getting into the Supreme Court's brief ruling on D.C. having voting rights in the House of Representatives. We're going to be talking about the Idaho Lieutenant Governor and what she's been doing, why the governor's in a way. We're also going to be taking a look at a busy Supreme Court season and some more. So, again, anything we don't get to on the main show, you'll have an opportunity to listen to on the Politics Guys bonus show. But before we get into the Politics Guys show, we're going to pause for a brief word from our sponsor. Well, Mike, welcome back. It's always going to be fun. Now, I know it's a little bit awkward in one way. I know that you and Jay, I mean, you really kind of tackled the debt ceiling thing. And for listeners, right, your takeaway point was it's time to raise it. It was like a kajillion dollars, right? Wasn't that what you?
Yeah, like a dodecagillion, some wild number. Yeah.
I just like that. Right, we just need to raise it to this big amount. Now, it sounds like Schumer and McConnell did not take your advice. I don't know what it is about being an academic, but nobody ever pays attention to us. So, you know, I don't know. They didn't raise it to a kajillion. Instead, this past Thursday, Schumer and McConnell independently announced and then was able to get past filibuster terms with the help of 11 Republicans to raise the debt limit. And instead of doing it to a specific date, they attached an amount of money, specifically $480 billion. The Treasury Department estimates this week that that is going to extend the drop deadline to December 3rd of this year. Or another way of looking at it, the current national debt is $28.4 trillion. This is going to allow it to rise to $28.8 trillion. And as a result, as we kind of see, the market rallied. Now, to be clear, although McConnell was clearly the driving force behind this, not all Republicans were happy about it. And McConnell has also made it clear, Mike, that this is just an opportunity for Democrats to pass a longer solution, in his view, under reconciliation. As McConnell put it earlier this week, quote, "We will allow Democrats to use normal procedures to pass an emergency debt limit extension at a fixed dollar amount to cover current spending levels into December." However, he goes on, "This is just going to moot Democrats' excuses about the time crunch they created and give the unified Democratic government more than enough time to pass standalone debt limit legislation through reconciliation," end quote. So Democrats have not wanted to go through that reconciliation process. They still clearly don't want to go through that process, as, again, you and Jay have talked about that. So I know you've talked about this, but has any of your feelings on this changed on the basis of what's happened yesterday with the 11 additional votes and McConnell pushing this through? Let's start there.
Not really. It seems to me that Mitch McConnell did more or less what I would expect him to do. I think initially I was surprised that the filibuster was defeated. But given the fact that that doing this to reconciliation is going to take longer, and the fact that the markets really hate the idea of this even being a thing, it seems like sort of the least that the Senate Republicans could do. And I think that's exactly what Mitch McConnell wants to do, is have the fewest Republican fingerprints on this thing without, you know, destroying the economy. And that to me is what happened.
Are we just going to be back to this again on, you know, at the end of November? I mean, do you think that this is going to give Democrats the space to do the reconciliation process? Or do you think Democrats are just going to wait till the end moment again and see if McConnell will once again give him an out?
I think this is as much of an out as Democrats are likely to get. You know, to me, it was interesting looking at those 11 Republicans who voted to invoke cloture on this. I looked at the names, and what I realized was that basically it was the majority of the Republican Senate leadership. You got McConnell, Thune, Grasso, and Blunt, but not Ernst or Scott. Two members of the GOP Senate caucus who are retiring, Shelby and Portman, and Blunt's also retiring, though he's in leadership. And then four of what I guess you could call the most moderate Senate Republicans, Collins, Murkowski, Capito, and Rounds. And so that, to me, that's pretty much it. If push comes to shove, you maybe get a Romney and one or two more on board that. But I think that's pretty much as far as the Senate Republicans are willing to go. And they want Democrats to own this debt ceiling increase. And I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, again, this has happened before. As a matter of fact, it's funny. I took a look back as you guys had talked about it, and this is something that I know that Jay had chatted about a little bit too. But it's not as if Democrats haven't voted against the debt ceiling limit. Matter of fact, Joe Biden himself did that, arguing under George W. Bush that he wasn't going to do it. It was no more spending, right? Too much spending under George W. Bush. I know that a lot of time is kind of spent on the haggling between Republicans and Democrats, but I mean, it seems like this is one of those things that we study. I mean, so for example, I think very much about the idea of issue and position taking and kind of staking your position out. It feels like one of these problems that will continue to be a problem, but can't really have a solution because everybody likes being able to use it when they're in the proper circumstance.
I agree in part, but I will say that this is generally speaking something that Republicans do. For the most part, it's Republicans in the Senate who or in the House, depending on the partisan control, who want to use the debt ceiling as a for political leverage. And it also is interesting to me that essentially no other country in the world has a debt ceiling like this. According to research I did, the Council of Foreign Relations says that the only other major Western country with anything like this is Denmark. But theirs is set so high relative to their debt that basically breaching it is not even an issue. So we've set up a system where we have to periodically say, well, will the United States government agree to honor its debts? Which is crazy. Of course, the United States government is going to honor its debts. And the fact that we've built in this structural mechanism to call this into question, to allow a party to use this as leverage is just unconscionable.
Well, it's weird. As a matter of fact, it emerges out of World War II. I don't know if you knew that. The structure in which we currently do it, where we bifurcate the two, starts in 1939 when Congress eventually removes the way that they separate spending from debt. And as a result, you then get a general restriction on debt in a way that you don't on spending. And that's the beginning of what we think of as being the debt limit or the debt ceiling. And I don't know if it's just for those of us who are curious, the original debt limit, right? So that ceiling was $45 billion back in 39.
But does that make sense to you, Trey?
It's always interesting to know where it comes from. In the case here, I don't want to say that it's an idea. I mean, what I think is problematic here, and it's something that I've talked about before, is that by taking the two apart, you seemingly can make arguments. And again, I mean, this is one, as a matter of fact, I remember this happened in Ohio to Portman when Democrats ran against him when he voted for increasing the debt ceiling and all the scary music. But really, increasing the debt limit is just about, as you had noted, paying the bills you've already agreed that you're going to spend money on. By separating the two, I think we actually take the pain away from having actual spending and having to think about the ramifications of spending. I know this is an issue where, Ken and I often disagree, and we don't talk about this as much. But I'm more fiscally conservative than Ken, but that doesn't take much to be more fiscally conservative than Ken. That's a pretty low bar to step over. So we've never had a chance to talk about it. So I don't know where do you fall on that idea? Because again, if you tied those back together, that would undoubtedly probably make spending money a little bit harder.
I don't know that it would, but I think that just as a matter of good public policy, there's a reason why almost no other country in the world has anything like this. And generally speaking, I think when literally everyone else is doing one thing and you're doing something else like this, or like, for instance, having some sort of system of universal health care, you might want to at least take a pause, take a beat, and look at yourself, as opposed to saying, well, clearly every other country in the world has this wrong and we're the only ones with the right answer. That to me is an indication that we need to take a look, that sometimes American exceptionalism is not a good thing. Sometimes it is. But in this case, I think it clearly isn't. The markets have clearly indicated that it's not. They don't like this. And so to me, this is an example of putting, I guess you'd call it, electoral optics before the public good,
I agree, Mike. And here's what I've often wondered, and maybe this is a way we can kind of bring this in a slightly different direction than you guys did last week and the week before. And that is, so in a system like ours, right? So there's a famous work by a researcher called David Mayhew. I know you're familiar with that, who argues that what individual congresspersons are going to do is about getting reelected, and all their activities. And he thinks there's kind of three big activities, but whatever. Point being for listeners is, what your activities are all going to involve is getting reelected, not necessarily what you'd think of as being the best governing. So if that thesis is correct, and I think for most of us in academia, we think that we're somewhere in that vein of Mayhew. How can you get out of the cycle of where something like this, where it's really effective? I mean, this is really effective when you are the party looking forward to the midterm elections. It always will be. So you don't want to get rid of it, even though it's probably everybody on some level recognizes it's a disastrous idea. In what ways can we kind of try to get around those institutional problems to get to better governing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is, people who are more concerned with the public good than they are with being reelected, and good luck with that. There are maybe a handful. Our system rewards getting reelected above all, and the sort of people who put their personal political stakes above the stakes for the country, whether it's this or healthcare or climate change or a million other things that, or things that, that conservatives take issue with maybe rightly. Like, for instance, I think there's a reasonable case to be made that federal spending as a percentage of GDP, which I think is probably, the best way to look at it fairly, is out of control, because we're not fighting Hitler and the Axis powers in World War II. But you take a look at the sort of U-shaped curve of that, it hasn't been this high since World War II. And I don't necessarily agree with, you in the sense that
fair.
It's that much as a problem, because when I look at, for instance, debt as our debt payments, or interest payments as a percent of GDP, that's actually down from the mid 80s and the early 90s. Or when I look at interest rates, there's been a spike lately in, say, consumer price. But when I look at the willingness of creditors around the world to lend the United States money at incredibly low rates, that hasn't changed at all. So while I do think that you and other fiscal conservatives are right, that at some point we reach a point where we can't borrow anymore at a decent interest rate. But to me, if I'm a market-oriented person, which I pretty much, you know, am, I would say, well, let's let the market decide when that happens. And clearly, international financial markets say the safest bet in the world is investing in the United States government. And so we don't see any sign of that changing. And so for now, we're good, though. I do agree with you that there's some point at some trillions of dollars number where we're not good. But I don't think we're at that point. I think we could pass the entirety of the $3.5 trillion package, which I know won't happen. It's one of my liberal pipe dreams, and another one on top of that, and we would be okay. But that's kind of where I'm at with this.
I understand. I mean, I think the part where we're going to have some disagreement is to say, I don't think you want to get to the point where you see major market indicators, because I think when you look at that comparatively, historically, what you see is oftentimes by the time you have that specific tipping point, you've gone too far, you're at a point where it's hard to bring it back. So I think for many of us who kind of fall on that side, I agree with you. I don't think we have yet hit that point, but maybe I'm particularly a little more nervous about it in one way, because while I recognize that we don't have those indicators, oftentimes when you look at historic examples, once you start seeing those indicators, it's almost too late, especially when you have a system that's difficult to change. You know, you don't change policy rapidly in that sense. Now, yeah. where I will give a lot, I think, the left a lot of credit is when you take a look at the total public outstanding debt, you know, a ton of it has happened in the last few years. And part of that has happened under the Republican watch. And the reason for that is there not, I mean, we have to think about spending, but we also have to think about taxing on the other hand. And, if you really are concerned about debt, that means you can't simultaneously keep spending at certain levels and then decrease tax revenue. And so I'm always willing to kind of give that on the other side as well. But
well, to give the right, I'll go right back on that. Then to give the right some credit, you know, when the Republicans passed the $1.5 trillion tax cut, they could not have known that a few years later there would be a worldwide pandemic that we would basically need to spend trillions of dollars to support the economy through. And you know, that 1-2 punch, you take a look at one of my favorite websites in the entire world is the St. Louis Fed's economic research site, which is just full of charts and graphs and fun stuff for wonky people like that. And you take a look at that, you know, that federal debt, and there's that huge, just like up, not even like a sky, like a ski slope.
No, it's the Empire State Building. It's just like a wall.
Exactly. And so that's why, in a way, I'm not terrifically concerned, but I wanted to talk about that point you made about the indicators, because you're right. Sometimes those things can be lagging indicators. But I'll also point out that one of the most common indicators we use is the interest rate on 10-year treasuries. And of course, those are investors who are looking, well, that far out into the future. And so maybe that is, I would argue, a slightly less lagging indicator than many, which is not to disagree with your point entirely, but just to say that I think that's maybe a little less so than something like, say, looking at the housing market for, you know, in the previous recession, that being pretty much a lagging indicator and some other things like that.
That's a fair point. Now, you know, the last piece here that I wanted to kind of talk about on this, Mike, is to think about the fact, right, we still do, and we don't want to spend too much time, we still do have, of course, two big spending hopes coming from the Biden administration and from, but to get them through, they're going to need reconciliation. But we only have one more reconciliation to go. Do you think the fact that we've now extended this, but McConnell's put the stamp on it, changes any of the calculus on that, makes it a little bit more difficult since we're going to need to see that coming via a singular reconciliation process?
I don't think so, because as I understand that there's a way to work the Senate rules where they can get two reconciliation bills before the end of the year. So I don't really think that's a problem. And if they need to massage the process in the end, I think they'll have the votes to do that sort of thing, as opposed to just something more radical like doing away with the filibuster, which I don't think will happen. You know, and I got to say, speaking of radical, that idea that I'm sure you've heard a few times when this comes up is that idea of minting a $1 trillion platinum coin as sort of a solution to the debt ceiling thing. And I kind of, there's a certain appeal to that, as some listeners may know. Under legislation Congress passed most recently in 2001, the Treasury Department, the Treasury Secretary, can basically authorize the minting of a platinum coin at any value without congressional approval. And so there's nothing, that law, as if read literally, means that, you know, Janet Yellen could say, here's a $1 trillion coin, and we're just going to draw on that. And I think I've seen some fanciful and interesting designs, that sort of thing. And that's one way out of it. But somehow I don't think Janet Yellen is going to take that option.
No, I mean, I think the amount of blowback that would create in the confidence. yeah, but it is interesting where people will go when they think here's the way. But but I think we should probably
You know, say before we, I think in terms of how this will play out, I am with a high degree of confidence. I think this gets taken care of, and we get the $1 trillion, half a trillion dollars in new spending infrastructure bill, and we get around $2 trillion in the other bill before the end of the year. I would be extremely surprised if those three things didn't happen.
It's fun that you mentioned that, because I had a bunch of students ask me about that, and I had put it at 1.8. So
I can see that. Yeah,
we're close.
I mean, Manchin has indicated a little more flexibility. So, but yeah, I think it comes in at under $2 trillion, and that's what Jay, I believe, said last week. So there seems to be something of an emerging politics guys consensus on this.
All agree, right? So the fact that it must be true.
There you go. Absolutely.
Well, before we turn over and kind of change our attention to what's been going on with Facebook and with the whistleblower in Congress, we're going to take a brief break and have a word from our sponsors. Well, welcome back to the Politics Guys. Thank you for being with us. So, Mike, this week, this is really kind of my area. This is what I'm always curious about, is social media and politics. And Tuesday, we have Frances Hugin come to the Senate floor to report on, snitch on, I'm not sure what the right term here is, Facebook. And this follows numerous reports from the Wall Street Journal of some pretty poor behavior at best from Facebook. What she reported to lawmakers was that Facebook is pushing products that knowingly harm children and young adults, and makes some explicit comparisons to the tobacco industry. Now, that's also a neat comparison, in part because I noticed a few weeks ago that has been something that scholars have been talking about for some time, especially when it comes to some of Facebook's public responses, where they compared them side by side with what had happened in the past with the tobacco industry. As for the Wall Street Journal, despite Facebook promising to release more information in the wake and arguing that what had been coming out was false, or at least maybe not put into the proper context, all Facebook to the date has done is publish some slides decks on their research. They haven't actually released any of the research or the data to get hands on. So, I know, isn't it crazy? And something I want to include here is, you know, we talk about this as scholars can, but, you know, for me, and this might not be the same way, but I think maybe listeners should think, anytime that you don't allow independent research or to let your data come out, that is when all of your, you know, all of your researcher tentacles should emerge from the back of your brain and be like, what is going on here? You know, I'll even kind of share a personal story. A lot of my early research dealing with presidential politics and communication surrounded social media, but I wasn't able to continue a lot of it, in part because Facebook, Twitter, and other sites began restricting the access to their information, to the point where today, for example, you know, there's really no way to conduct any kind of research on what's happening on Facebook, and even doing so can put you into potential legal jeopardy. And that was always kind of sad, but I understand what Facebook is doing. They're, you know, manipulating things. So, but to get back to what's happening this particular week, one of the big things to come out during the reports to Congress is how Facebook specifically manipulates your news feed to produce engagement. even, and this is what's kind of key here, when that's harmful to behavior. So for example, it will prioritize bad information because that bad information will rile you up and get you to interact with that information in a way that you wouldn't have, say, you know, like my daughter's picture or something. Additionally, both from reports to Congress and from the Wall Street Journal, we have looking at Instagram's effect on young girls, where Instagram itself had research suggesting that they were harming young girls, which, as a matter of fact, recently led the company to pull products specifically designed for children. An Instagram for kids is what that was going to be called. Facebook, we've also learned from the reports to Congress, was internally very deeply worried that January 6th was its problem and that their platform was one of the primary reasons for the ability of individuals to get together and do this. So we've got a lot going on here. So Mike, I know this isn't always quite your area, but what does this say to you? And, you know, we continue to see both sides of the aisle want to have different kinds of regulations of social media, but for very different kinds of reasons. And then we get this bomb kind of dropped on us. Those of us who are paying attention, maybe it's not as surprising, but nevertheless, a bomb. What do you think happens from here?
Well, I guess my initial response is, this is about as surprising as someone saying to me, you know, my dog likes hamburger. Really? Oh, this is just astonishing. Does anyone not know this? Does anyone who's paying, even halfway paying attention, not know that in Huggins' words, that Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy? Come on. Of course they do. And of course Facebook is going to bury any data that demonstrates that supports that view. They're not going to share that. They don't have a legal obligation to do that, so they're not. I mean, that to me, in a weird way, I don't even really blame Facebook. I mean, they're acting within the law, as far as we know. And this idea that corporate entities will say, you know what, we could make a lot of money here, but let's not do that for corporate social responsibility reasons. That's just, if you think that happens on any widespread basis, you're living in a delusional world. And so this to me is, well, no kidding. And we get these ridiculous messages from people like Senator Markey, you know, who said that stood up. I don't know if he stood up. Maybe he stood up. He should have. Here's my message from Mark Zuckerberg. Your time of invading our privacy, promoting toxic content, and preying on our children and teens is over. And my first thought was, no, it's not. This is not. The whole thing just makes me, number one, roll my eyes, and number two, make me sick. At the same time, I guess I'm retching as I roll my eyes at all of this. That's kind of my response to it.
So, I mean, one of the questions here that I think emerges is that for those who are paying attention, you know, I don't think this is surprising. Like, it's the dog to the hamburger. But I would say that there is evidence to suggest that I don't know how widespread that knowledge is among all users. For example, even here at OC, I have had students do a variety of different kinds of low-level researches, of course. But the basic amount of knowledge of, say, even how your news feed is presented in front of you is not maybe as widely known as I would have anticipated. And this is in part due, I think, to a gap. We have this expectation that younger people are particularly technology savvy, but what really they are is they're just technology they kind of have a comfortableness with it being around. It's not that they're savvy about its use or its underlying functions. And so, you know, in that light, I'm not sure, you know, when you say that this is, I mean, for you, for me, and for other people who pay attention, so a lot, probably a lot of people listening to the show, it's probably not surprising. I'm not sure, though, if it's so much like the dog and the hamburger for the wider population. What do you think about that?
Well, I'll just assume that I'm completely wrong and you are completely right about that point, that for most people, it's not like that. I guess my larger question and response to that is sort of a so what, because I don't think in the end that people who aren't in that very small, engaged politically engaged minority really care too much about the concept of democracy or the broader concept of harming our children or stoking division. What they care about and what matters to them is, here is this thing, and I get pleasure from using it. It is a part of my life, whether that's a good pleasure or a bad addictive pleasure, which you and I think probably to an extent agree that it is. I don't think it matters even if everyone were somehow made to realize that their privacy and their feeds are being manipulated, and this on some meta level is bad for democracy. I think people would say, it's fine. I don't care.
Well, what does that then tell us, though? I mean, so since we're going to go down into the depths of despair here together.
Just doomed. Yeah, basically we're going down. We've hit the iceberg. The ship is sinking, and you know we're worried about replacing the towel racks on the
So there really is no positive. So one of the questions I was going to have, so I'm just going to throw it out right here, is, I mean, so is there oftentimes when we have new technologies come down the pike, there's a period of worrying about how they're going to be affected, the kind of early on negative effects, and then they kind of settle into some kind of institutional. I'm thinking about a lot of people's thoughts about, for example, what would happen with radio and then television, right?
Sure.
But of course, I know that, you know, both of us maybe take a slightly harder view, right? I mean, we think back to like Postman's work, entertaining ourselves to death, and we laugh because he didn't realize they'd be carrying it around in our pockets. Is there any hope here that we can institutionalize this kind of thing in a positive way, or to have guardrails on it that allow democracy to continue to thrive in a world in which you don't obviously think anyone's really going to stand up and stop Facebook wholesale or whatever the you know, again, we'll sound like we're talking about old platforms in 10 years, but you get the point there.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to think so, but there's some points for people to keep in mind. You know, Facebook is the fifth largest American company based on market cap. All right. It's worth almost $1 trillion. And 1 through 4, the four standard tech companies, right? Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon. And right now in 2020, Facebook spent almost $20 million on lobbying. Only 5 organizations spent more. And in the last 2 years, Facebook increased their lobbying expenditures by around 56%. What they're spending is a ton, and they could very, very easily open the floodgates and spend orders of magnitude more than that. And that's why I think that Ed Markey and whatnot can talk, and the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal can write about bipartisan consensus. But the best thing that's going to happen, I think, that we can reasonably expect is what Facebook is calling for. They're calling for, you know, revisions to the CDA and so forth, but it's going to be window dressing. It's going to be the appearance of a fix that allows them to continue on with their business model, which is awesome for Facebook and disastrous for American democracy.
So then on that vein, I'm going to ask kind of one more question here, Mike.
Yeah.
Given that one of the things that Facebook internally was so worried about, and you know, you're talking about this disastrous to democracy, what do you think about that potential connection between Facebook and January 6th?
Well, you know, I think there absolutely is a connection, and certainly Facebook and other social media made it easier. I mean, it makes it easier for people to find each other and organized and like-minded people to get together. And whether that's, you know, the cat lovers of the greater Peoria region or people who think that hang Mike Pence is a great motto. You know, I mean,
where did you get the cat lovers? You didn't even miss a beat. It was like you were waiting for a question. Your
skinny,
whole life.
Wasn't it? I know. I don't know. It just popped into my head. It's a weird sort of thing. I don't know. It's a strange time of day. I'm feeling odd. Maybe I'm off or on.
No,
my
you were
meds.
Not. That was the most on you have ever been. Like, I mean, there wasn't even a pause, sir. There was.
I did not even write that out. No. But yeah, I got to say, in terms of if Congress were serious about this, if they could somehow overcome the great lobbying might of Facebook and, you know, an associated social media companies do the same thing on a on kind of a lower level. I think what they do, and I'm going to get on my soapbox, I've talked about this before, what a real change would look like would be as Facebook wants, revising Section 230 of the CDA, but it would be revising it to classify any service that makes editorial decisions about who gets what content gets promoted, aside from first in, first posted, you know what I'm saying?
Twitter.
And they don't get that liability protection. And that would mean, like, for instance, Reddit would be fine, because Reddit is just a user, a user run. You don't posts don't pop up or down. It's all based on user votes. And I think that would be fine. But what Facebook is doing is completely within the law. And unless there's a really fundamental change made to that legal structure, they're going to keep on doing it. And while I hope I'm wrong, more than anything, except for maybe climate change, I hope I'm wrong about the dysfunction of government, because I think this is only second to climate change in a lot of ways in terms of my portents of doom. I just don't see a lot of reason to be optimistic, but maybe I'll look back in a year and say, and I hope so, mea culpa, I was totally wrong, and I would be so happy to do that.
I've often thought, I agree with you that would be one mechanism to change things. And I agree with you that the likelihood that that's going to happen is low. But I've often wondered if there couldn't be space, again, it would still be unlikely, but maybe more space to change legislation as it regards data collection to prevent the, in other words, if you can prevent the idea that you're going to provide services through this kind of manipulation via data collection. In short, you can't have platforms that can exchange services for data. And if in some ways you could end that as a legal matter, you would then destroy the potential business model to want to manipulate those kinds of sources the way we see, or that presentation of information the way we kind of see. And again, I don't think, since it's not as straightforward, if maybe that could be a more likely scenario, because it could be tied into other things, as we already know, not that we talked about this here, but just the, your location and GPS data ought to be private to you. And by making that more private, you could potentially alter the business models of Facebook. But again, you're right. The likelihood of those are low when you have those stakeholders.
I imagine the lobbying campaign already. Congress wants to take away free Facebook, right? Wants to make you pay for the service we're giving you for free. And I think what would happen is they'd say, well, we'll make it a more clear opt-in option thing, and then the big choice box will be, you can either pay $20 a month for Facebook or get it for free as long as you agree to your information being shared. And you know what the vast majority of people will do.
Well, no, we do have a little bit of data on that in the terms of what's happened recently with Apple and your ability. Companies now that are going to track have to pop that up, and they can put it however they want, but they have to pop that up to let you know, and you have to be able to opt in.
Sure.
And the answer we know is, even when you think it's going to end the service, I mean, they have some pretty dire, like, if you don't say yes, this won't exist. There is barely a 2% opt-in on iOS on the newest versions. That's not what I would have expected, to be honest, Mike. But it does suggest potentially that people, weirdly, would be willing on some cases to vote against the free, unless they just don't really believe the warning.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. But I will point out that model is not that. The way of doing business is not central to Apple's business model in the way it is.
Oh, no. I was thinking, like, even for the apps, the apps get to pop up and say, hey, if you by clicking no, you're going to kill us. As a matter of fact, Facebook is one of the ones who had that just kind of dire set of warnings about the tracking. But you're right. Of course, Apple is able to kind of take that. I'm not trying to suggest, I'm an Apple fan. We all know that. In this case, though, I wasn't trying to give him a pass. I was just suggesting some data. Continue. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I hope you're right about that. I hope that these are signs we can point to and say that maybe people do care enough about privacy and manipulation. But I also think on the other side of this is that maybe people do care about this, but I think also that people love having their beliefs confirmed and strengthened. And so the sort of thing, there may be two pieces of this. There's the manipulation and privacy piece, but there's also the kind of partisan echo chamber sort of piece. And that, I think that's pretty clear that most people who are at all interested in politics are interested in that sort of thing. You know, just a couple weeks ago on the podcast, right, Jay and I were talking about this, and I said, you know, take a look at the list of the top podcasts on Apple Podcasts. They're all far left, far right, echo chambery sort of things, because people love that stuff. We are here, you and I, and most all politics guys listeners, except for the small minority who like hate listen for one of our hosts or not. You know, we're not normal, and I mean that as a compliment, right? But that's not how most Americans are, and that's unfortunate, but I think that's just a reality of it.
Well, I mean, and there's a lot of truth there. I mean, I can't, when you say that, all I can think of is Joe Rogan, and it's true. It's true. Well, I think what we should do here is probably might take a break for a minute and allow our sponsors to have a moment, and then when we come back, we'll talk about the Texas abortion injunction. Well, welcome back to the Politics Guys. Thanks for listening through the break. Mike, before we had gotten done, we were talking about and thinking about Facebook, and now we're going to kind of pivot and move in a different direction. We're going to be chatting about Texas, because we had some pretty big news coming out of Texas. The U.S. District Court and the Justice, specifically Robert Pittman, granted a temporary stay from Texas law SB 8. That is the law that blocked abortions in Texas by placing a $10,000 bounty for anyone who reported an abortion over 6 weeks. And this is actually something that Mike, you and myself and Kristen on our three-person show a number of weeks ago got to take on when it first happened. And things didn't go maybe exactly as we planned at the Supreme Court. But nevertheless, the Supreme Court had earlier declined to intervene. But now the DOJ has brought a suit, and the court has declared that using this weird method of enforcement, that is letting private citizens sue effectively for bounties, doesn't allow it to bypass constitutional words. Or in the actual written opinion of Judge Pittman, quote, a person's rights under the Constitution to choose to obtain an abortion prior to fetal viability is well established. Fully aware that depriving its citizens of this right by direct state action would be flagrantly unconstitutional, the state contrived an unprecedented and transparent statutory scheme to do just that. End quote. So I think now the question really becomes, what happens next? Texas has already appealed this to the circuit court. So what does this mean? I mean, again, I know that we've talked on the three-person show about kind of our feelings on this. And I think this is another one of those areas where we had kind of some broad agreement about finding this particular enforcement mechanism to be distasteful. But the Supreme Court, clearly, it was at least willing to not put the stay on it. It's now only since at the district court level with this new suit from the DOJ, which lends us to wonder, well, what happens then is this inevitably makes its way back up to the Supreme Court in this slightly different mechanism or this slightly different case. Excuse me.
Well, I got to say, you know, the crafters of SB 8, they were clever. Clever individuals, because there's a provision in the law saying that if, in fact, there is, it is temporarily suspended for an order just like this one, that anyone who would have been able, would been liable for a lawsuit under it, can be sued retroactively while for, you know, services, abortion services they provided while the law wasn't in effect. So, I mean, this was well crafted for its intended purpose. They knew the chilling effect it would have. Even if at some point it is declared unconstitutional, it would stop, or it would certainly staunch what they see as the horrific flow of abortions for an extended period of time. And that's, you know, it seems to be exactly what is happening. And some people think that's wonderful, and some people are outraged at that sort of thing. And I mean, it seems to me, I don't know what's going to happen at the Fifth Circuit. I do know it's one of the most conservative circuit courts in the federal court system. Right now, of the 17 active judges, 12 were appointed by Republicans, including 6 Trump appointees. So it kind of, in part, depends on what, you know, what three-judge panel hears that. But in the end, I think that the Supreme Court was hoping that they would be able to sort of punt on this issue until they could either, a lower court could decide it and they could decide not to hear it, or until they could hear the Mississippi law, which is a different law, which was decided in a much more, was passed in a much more kind of traditional way, not this weird vigilante justice enforcement mechanism that they're going to be hearing that case in their new term and deciding on that. And maybe they have it in mind that, well, we're going to open the floodgates, essentially end Roe versus Wade without necessarily flat out declaring it unconstitutional, which I believe Ken thinks would be what's going to happen. And I tend to agree with Ken on that. So, there's no way that this is constitutional under current Roe versus Wade and other current precedents, but those precedents might not be around after, well, I think the court hears the Mississippi case, I believe, in
November,
December. Want to say, so it's going to be the biggest case of the term. So that decision will probably come out in June of 2022. So that would be my kind of the date I would be looking at for that.
So you think in the meantime, because the Mississippi case is going to be the more important case, that this might effectively, stay or no stay, it doesn't really matter.
It's hard for me to see how the Fifth Circuit legitimately overturns this stay from Judge Pittman. I just don't. I mean, just given the precedent, maybe they go back to using the five members in the majority on the Supreme Court, their argument saying that, well, this is just new and we want to let it play out. Basically, maybe they look at the standing issue because Texas argued that the federal government just doesn't have standing because the federal government hasn't suffered a direct harm. Now, the Justice Department has argued that its standing comes from the law's violation of the Constitution's Supremacy Clause. But maybe the Fifth Circuit says, no, we don't see it that way. And in which case, then you have to kind of wait for, and there have been some individuals who do have standing who I believe have filed suits. So maybe you wait for those cases to play out. And again, I thought that the end game for Texas for a while now is whether this is ultimately upheld at the Supreme Court or not, it means that there are going to be fewer abortions after 6 weeks that are performed, which again is like 85-90% of all abortions. And so they're getting what they want out of this law. And so that's clever bill crafting.
So, you know, one of the things that makes me think as we've continued, this has obviously been on the forefront, it's going to continue to be an issue as we move forward. And that is, you know, as a country, one of the things that we have just not found agreement on is some place to decide what we want to think about in terms of what is or isn't a person. And it seems to me that because we keep doing it at this, we both want to have a national standard, but at the same time want states to take up the individual cases, that we're going to continue to have issues like Texas. Is it time for Congress to act, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, I mean, I guess Congress could pass legislation, but I agree with you on the fundamental point, right? That it all gets down to personhood. But even then, if you say, well, it's a slippery slope, right? It's not I think fetal viability is a good demarcation line between weighing the rights of a woman to do what she wants with her own body and the rights of a state in protecting life. And so it seems to me that the most logical place to draw that line is where the court did it back in 1973, is you're a person when you can survive outside the womb. But at the same time, I think that the state has a non-zero interest in preserving potential life. I get that. But does that mean then that there's a law against it, that under those grounds, depending on how far you want to take it back, then there should be a law against masturbation, right? I mean, because there you go, potential life.
And that's been my problem. You know, I am probably more conservative on this one than – I'm definitely more conservative than, say, Ken. Again, this is not one we've talked about. But for me, and I understand you know, you talk about that slippery slope, and it depending on which direction of the mountain you're on, you're slipping a different direction. And it's what I think becomes particularly difficult here, as I've often kind of thought, is that the court, because of the circumstance it's in, and you know, you're talking about viability, is, and again, viability has shifted a little bit as time has gone on, and that too means that we have a potential issue. Now, maybe it's more stable today than it ever has been. Maybe it's not going to change in a significant way anymore. But I guess, you know, it's hard to make those kinds of predictions forever. But
yeah,
it almost feels a little bit like that sense of, you know, we're shooting at this wall, and we're trying to figure out if there's anybody behind it. So, right, you know, when does your right to exercise your right to shoot interfere with the potentiality that somebody's behind the wall? And it's a really difficult one for me, because on the one hand, I being libertarian sympathetic, I recognize that a woman has a right to do things with her body, and especially as a man, I have to be careful in how I'm arguing about that, because you know, that's not something that can happen to me personally. And so I think anytime you're talking about a right that doesn't affect you, you need to be particularly careful and give the other person a lot of leeway in what's going to happen to them. But then at the same time, we have this potential person, and for me personally, it's really difficult, you know, to think about, well, is it viability? And at what point, it's hard. And I think one of the things that I particularly hate about this law is instead of having to deal with the hardness, instead of having to deal with the complexity and the frustration there, instead we just use this weird method to try to bypass that whole difficult conversation.
I agree. And I think, you know, when you asked, is it time for Congress to act, it kind of brought me up short, because I feel like this is an issue of a fundamental right. And so I guess I would say that I don't feel so much that Congress should act through legislation, but I feel that this particular right to this particular privacy right needs, well, could perhaps be beneficially explained, be laid out more clearly in the Constitution as a fundamental right. Now, I don't know what that would look like, but I think that would address the issue of the Supreme of nine justices just deciding where this line is. I would much prefer, and as I do for almost any issue, when there is constitutional ambiguity, because as you know, and as listeners know, there is no specifically listed right to privacy in the Constitution. It's found in all sorts
penumbra.
Of different. Exactly. And we laugh at that term, but we also in a way know that is true, because we believe that a right to privacy from government interference with our persons is a fundamental right. And so I certainly would not be adverse to some sort of a privacy amendment being in the Constitution. And that could cover not just a person, but a person's, well, personal data, getting to the Facebook and other issues, because pretty clearly this privacy right issue was not something that the framers thought of in the same way that we do for a lot of reasons, many of them technological. And, you know, the Constitution was designed to be updated and changed and modified with the times. And the framers certainly thought that would happen. But we've basically, that process has ground to a halt. And you have these people holding up their pocket constitutions like they're Moses coming down from Mount Sinai and saying, well, this is it, guys, you know. And this ignorance of history and what the framers expected, I think, is problematic.
I deeply agree on that front. So when I was talking about Congress, that is precisely what I was talking about.
Oh, okay.
I have always found this is where Ken might disagree with me. I have always found the privacy penumbra issue to be a partially self-created issue because of an unwillingness of justices, I think, to take the 10th Amendment seriously to include more items. And this is where I think a conservative view of the Constitution would have been, right? There are a number of rights like privacy. And I think the idea was in the 10th Amendment, what anti-federalists were trying to get at was, things will change more rapidly than we're going to be always having constitutional amendments. What do we do about that? Anti-Federalists were worried precisely about that issue. And so to pass the Constitution, we get the 10th Amendment. But what Supreme Court justices have turned the 10th Amendment into, into the words of Sandra Day O'Connor, a truism, meaning anything we don't give to the national government it reserves. But I think right here is a great example of where we could have people rights. But the fact that we haven't done it that way, okay, here we are. And on that front, I deeply agree with you, Mike. We need to add... this idea that we couldn't have additional rights come via the Constitution, that somehow modifying that is terrible. And I think part of that Moses coming down from above, I've often thought that had the first Congress been willing, rather than stapling amendments onto the bottom, said we're actually going to rewrite the Constitution, that we might have been a little bit more psychologically willing to say this is a work in progress, not the thing that we're constantly stapling to the bottom. I've often wondered historically if that wasn't a mistake, although I don't think it was one maybe that would have been recognized at that moment.
Yeah. You know, also you mentioned the 10th Amendment. I want to give a shout out to the most forgotten amendment, sort of the middle child, if you will, of the Constitution, the 9th Amendment. But most people, you go jump right from 8 to 10, right? And then there's everything after that. But
well, and by most people, you mean the 20 who actually could list them all.
Exactly.
But go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm gonna read a whole sucker out because it's pretty short. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Now, that's a pretty big catch-all, right? I mean, it's, hey, there are these rights, other rights, just other. This is another category, right? Rights retained by the people, and we're not saying people don't have these rights. So what are they? Well, you could pretty much pour whatever you want into that. And the 9th Amendment, I think, has sort of famously just been, everyone keeps away from it because it's so vague. It's like, what the hell does that mean? I don't know, but there are these rights, apparently. People retain them. We don't know what they are, but damn it, we retain these rights, you know? So there it is. Maybe we need to put some meat on the bones and the outline of that 9th Amendment and specifically talk about the rights that people retain. Like, I would argue, most fundamentally is the right to privacy.
Maybe that could be the thing we do, Mike. Maybe we have a 9th Amendment movement.
9A, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, we have solved all of the world's problems, as usual, in an hour, Mike, but no one is going to listen.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's we need to get the right people to listen, right? So I know that listeners appreciate, and sometimes they disagree, and they let us know that on Discord or Facebook or the Reddit group, you know. But I think sometimes we can have these conversations, and I'm sure this happens to you in the classroom. Is there's this feeling of like, well, what are we doing here then? The forces arrayed against us, you know, the forces of good and light and wonderfulness seem to be so vast. But I think it's important to retain at least a sense of optimism and realize that, you know, social movements and how change happens is it tends to, you know, bubble up, and it takes time and effort. And one person tells another person, and if from a core of committed people, you can have a movement. And while most movements fail, not all of them do, and it's worth engaging in the fight, which is why we do what we do.
I love you say that, but it's so interesting how you kind of 180'd there from, like, you know, the democracy is coming to a very end, but
it's a bipolar. I wouldn't be doing this, right? I wouldn't be a political scientist. We wouldn't be doing this show if I didn't have some belief that this mattered. And sometimes it can just be hard because we're just relentlessly bombarded with either cynicism or radical extremism on both sides. And so you have the utopians on one side screaming about their perfect world, and then you have the cynics on the other side screaming we're all doomed, and those are the people who are promoted in the Facebook feeds, right? And so I think it's important to keep in mind that there are a lot of people who aren't like that, and if people of people of good heart and who are willing to put in the time and effort, band together and kind of have that continuous effort, that sometimes good things can happen. And if I didn't believe that, then I guess I would just, you know, quit the podcast and go live in the mountains with my wife and dogs, you know. But not today.
I still like the idea of the mountains, but to add to that, and we'll need to finish up, is to say that I think sometimes, you know, especially for listeners or others, and you think, you know, say, we can band together, we can do this, that seems overwhelming, and where do you start? And so one bit of maybe pragmatic suggestion I have here, and this comes, and again, I want to make it explicit, right? Not everyone is going to potentially share this particular kind of background, but that's what we do on the show. But this comes from my Christian ethos, this idea that we can do something local and we can love our neighbor in a really specific kind of way. And that can be the beginning of some really incredible changes and be the catalyst for moves. So, you know, if you're having that day where you just think that democracy is dying, then I highly recommend that you join me, you walk to work, you whatever, and you pick up a few pieces of trash, or you help one of the people along the way that you've seen all the time and you haven't, and make that something really specific. And I think that's the true beginning of movements that have power as they move forward. And I think that's part of what makes me think about how my Christianness can interact in a positive way in my community. And that can be the beginning for that, even when things seem to be despairing at a larger level.
Yeah, and if nothing else, there's less trash on your tree lawn or what have you, so there you go.
Exactly.
Hey, that's something.
Well, Ken, I just want to thank Ken. Oh, my goodness. Mike, I just want to thank you doing the show with me. I know that we didn't have Ken here today, but it's always fun to get to do it with you as well.
Absolutely.
So listeners, there's a bunch of things that Mike and I did not get to on this show. So if you want to be part of that, you can become a supporter of the Politics Guys. And, you know, Mike and I, we've been talking about this. We need your support to make these kinds of things work. Our love for this only goes so far. By becoming a supporter, you can get access to our bonus show. And now it's not available on Wednesday anymore. You get that right now as you're listening to this show. You'll have access almost immediately to the bonus show. And in this, Mike and I, we're going to take a look at a bunch of the stuff we didn't get to. We're going to talk about the Pandora Papers. We're going to talk about some developments going on between Taiwan and China and how it involves the United States. We're going to talk about Idaho and Lieutenant Governor. So if you want to get in on all of that, you can become a supporter of the show. There's also other advantages of becoming a supporter of the show. We have things like the Discord channel. You can chat with myself and with Mike and sometimes Ken. You can gain access to that with a supporter show. Now, if you're in a position where you can't do this, and this is one of the cool things about what we do with the show, you can actually reach out to Mike at mike@politicsguys.com and let him know, and he can still make the bonus show available to you. But if you want to become a supporter of the show, or just check out the other cool benefits of being a supporter of the Politics Guys, you can go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can go to our website, politicsguys.com/support. Again, that's our Patreon page at patreon.com/politicsguys. So join, I guess next week it's going to be you and Jay, Mike, again, by and then, or if you want to hear more of me and Mike for right now, head to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just a random thought you'd like to share, you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. Today's show was produced by myself, Trey Orndorff. I hope you join us next time.